The Handmaid's Tale, Cassette 3.
We hear Serena coming down the stairs along the hall, the muffled tap of her cane on the rug, thud of the good foot. She hobbles through the doorway, glances at us, counting but not seeing. She nods at Nick but says nothing. She's in one of her best dresses, sky blue with embroidery in white along the edges of the veil, flowers and fretwork. Even at her age, she still feels the urge to wreathe herself in flowers. No use for you, I think at her, my face unmoving. You can't use them anymore. You're withered. They're the genital organs of plants. I read that somewhere once. She makes her way to her chair and footstool, turns, lowers herself, lands ungracefully. She hoists her left foot onto the stool, fumbles in her sleeve pocket. I can hear the rustling, the click of her lighter. I smell the hot singe of the smoke, breathe it in. Late as usual, she says. We don't answer. There's a clatter as she gropes on the lamp table, then a click, and the television set runs through its warm-up. A male choir with greenish-yellow skin, the color needs adjusting, they're singing, "Come to the church in the wildwood." Come, 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 sing the basses. Serena clicks the channel changer, waves, colored zigzags, a garble of sound. It's the Montreal satellite station being blocked. Then there's a preacher, earnest, with shining dark eyes, leaning towards us across a desk. These days they look a lot like businessmen. Serena gives him a few seconds, then clicks onward. Several blank channels, then the news. This is what she's been looking for. She leans back, inhales deeply. I, on the contrary, lean forward. A child being allowed up late with the grown-ups. This is the one good thing about these evenings, the evenings of the ceremony. I'm allowed to watch the news. It seems to be an unspoken rule in this household. We always get here on time. He's always late. Serena always lets us watch the news. Such as it is, who knows if any of it is true? It could be old clips. It could be faked. But I watch it anyway, hoping to be able to read beneath it. Any news now is better than none. First, the front lines. They are not lines, really. The war seems to be going on in many places at once. Wooded hills seen from above. The trees a sickly yellow. I wish he'd fix the color. The Appalachian Highlands, says the voiceover, where the angels of the apocalypse, 4th Division, are smoking out a pocket of Baptist guerrillas with air support from the 21st Battalion of the Angels of Light. We are shown 2 helicopters, black ones with silver wings painted on the sides. Below them, a clump of trees explodes. Now a close shot of a prisoner with a stubbled and dirty face, flanked by 2 angels in their neat black uniforms. The prisoner accepts a cigarette from one of the angels, puts it awkwardly to his lips with his bound hands. He gives a lopsided little grin. The announcer is saying something, but I don't hear it. I look into this man's eyes, trying to decide what he's thinking. He knows the camera is on him. Is the grin a show of defiance? Or is it submission? Is he embarrassed at having been caught? They only show us victories, never defeats. Who wants bad news? Possibly he's an actor. The anchorman comes on now. His manner is kindly, fatherly. He gazes out at us from the screen, looking with his tan and his white hair and candid eyes, wise wrinkles around them, like everybody's ideal grandfather. What he's telling us, his level smile implies, is for our own good. Everything will be all right soon, I promise. There will be peace. You must trust. You must go to sleep like good children. He tells us what we long to believe. He's very convincing. I struggle against him. He's like an old movie star, I tell myself, with false teeth and a face job. At the same time, I sway towards him like one hypnotized. If only it were true. If only I could believe. Now he's telling us that an underground espionage ring has been cracked by a team of eyes working with an inside informant. The ring has been smuggling precious natural resources over the border into Canada. 5 members of the heretical sect of Quakers have been arrested, he says, smiling blandly, and more arrests are anticipated. 2 of the Quakers appear on screen, a man and a woman. They look terrified, but they're trying to preserve some dignity in front of the camera. The man has a large, dark mark on his forehead. The woman's veil has been torn off and her hair falls in strands over her face. Both of them are about 50. Now we can see a city, again from the air. This used to be Detroit. Under the voice of the announcer, there's the thunk of artillery. From the skyline, columns of smoke ascend. Resettlement of the children of Ham is continuing on schedule, says the reassuring pink face back on the screen. 3,000 have arrived this week in National Homeland 1, with another 2,000 in transit. How are they transporting that many people at once? Trains? Buses? We are not shown any pictures of this. National Homeland 1 is in North Dakota. Lord knows what they're supposed to do once they get there. Farm is the theory. Serena Joy has had enough of the news. Impatiently, she clicks the button for a station change, comes up with an aging bass baritone, his cheeks like emptied udders. Whispering hope is what he's singing. Serena turns him off. We wait. The clock in the hall ticks. Serena lights another cigarette. I get into the car. It's a Saturday morning. It's a September. We still have a car. Other people have had to sell theirs. My name isn't of Fred. I have another name, which nobody uses now because it's forbidden. I tell myself it doesn't matter. Your name is like your telephone number, useful only to others, but what I tell myself is wrong. It does matter. I keep the knowledge of this name like something hidden, some treasure I'll come back to dig up one day. I think of this name as buried. This name has an aura around it, like an amulet, some charm that survived from an unimaginably distant past. I lie in my single bed at night with my eyes closed, and the name floats there behind my eyes, not quite within reach, shining in the dark. It's a Saturday morning in September. I'm wearing my shining name. The little girl, who is now dead, sits in the back seat with her 2 best dolls, her stuffed rabbit, mangy with age and love. I know all the details. They're sentimental details, but I can't help that. I can't think about the rabbit too much, though. I can't start to cry here on the Chinese rug, breathing in the smoke that has been inside Serena's body. Not here. Not now. I can do that later. She thought we were going on a picnic, and in fact, there is a picnic basket on the back seat beside her with real food in it, hard-boiled eggs, thermos and all. We didn't want her to know where we were really going. We didn't want to tell her by mistake, reveal anything if we were stopped. We didn't want to lay upon her the burden of our truth. I wore my hiking boots. She had on her sneakers. The laces of the sneakers had a design of hearts on them, red, purple, pink, and yellow. It was warm for the time of year. The leaves were turning already, some of them. Luke drove. I sat beside him. The sun shone. The sky was blue. The houses, as we passed them, looked comforting and ordinary. Each house, as it was left behind, vanishing into past time, crumbling in an instant, as if it had never been, because I would never see it again. Or so I thought then. We have almost nothing with us. We don't want to look as if we're going anywhere far or permanent. We have the forged passports, guaranteed, worth the price. We couldn't pay in money, of course, or put it on the CompuCount. We used other things, some jewelry that was my grandmother's, a stamp collection Luke inherited from his uncle, Such things can be exchanged for money in other countries. When we get to the border, we'll pretend we're just going over on a day trip. The fake visas are for a day. Before that, I'll give her a sleeping pill so she'll be asleep when we cross. That way she won't betray us. You can't expect a child to lie convincingly. And I don't want her to feel frightened, to feel the fear that is now tightening my muscles, tensing my spine, pulling me so taut that I'm certain I would break if touched. Every stoplight is an ordeal. We'll spend the night at a motel, or better, sleeping in the car on a side road, so there will be no suspicious questions. We'll cross in the morning, drive over the bridge easily, just like driving to the supermarket. We turn onto the freeway, head north, flowing with not much traffic. Since the war started, gas is expensive and in short supply. Outside the city, we pass the first checkpoint. All they want is a look at the license. Luke does it well. The license matches the passport. We thought of that. Back on the road, he squeezes my hand, glances over at me. "You're white as a sheet," he says. That is how I feel, white. Flat, thin. I feel transparent. Surely they will be able to see through me. Worse, how will I be able to hold on to Luke, to her, when I'm so flat, so white? I feel as if there's not much left of me. They will slip through my arms as if I'm made of smoke, as if I'm a mirage fading before their eyes. "Don't think that way," Mara would say. "Think that way and you'll make it happen." "Cheer up," says Luke. He's driving a little too fast now. The adrenaline's gone to his head. Now he's singing. "Oh, what a beautiful morning," he sings. Even his singing worries me. "We've been warned not to look too happy." 15. The commander knocks at the door. The knock is prescribed. The sitting room is supposed to be Serena Joy's territory. He's supposed to ask permission to enter it. She likes to keep him waiting. It's a little thing, but in this household, little things mean a lot. Tonight, however, she doesn't even get that, because before Serena Joy can speak, he steps forward into the room anyway. Maybe he's just forgotten the protocol, but maybe it's deliberate. Who knows what she said to him over the silver-encrusted dinner table, or didn't say? The commander has on his black uniform, in which he looks like a museum guard, a semi-retired man, genial but wary, killing time. But only at first glance. After that, he looks like a Midwestern bank president, with his straight, neatly brushed silver hair, his sober posture, shoulders a little stooped. And after that, there is his mustache, silver also, and after that, his chin, which you really can't miss. When you get down as far as the chin, he looks like a vodka ad in a glossy magazine of times gone by. His manner is mild, his hands large with thick fingers and acquisitive thumbs, his blue eyes uncommunicative, falsely innocuous. He looks us over as if taking inventory. One kneeling woman in red, one seated woman in blue, two in green standing, a solitary man thin-faced in the background. He manages to appear puzzled, as if he can't quite remember how we all got in here. As if we are something he inherited, like a Victorian pump organ, and he hasn't figured out what to do with us, what we are worth. He nods in the general direction of Serena Joy, who does not make a sound. He crosses to the large leather chair reserved for him, takes the key out of his pocket, fumbles with the ornate, brass-bound, leather-covered box that stands on the table beside the chair. He inserts the key, opens the box, lifts out the Bible, an ordinary copy with a black cover and gold-edged pages. The Bible is kept locked up, the way people once kept tea locked up so the servants wouldn't steal it. It is an incendiary device. Who knows what we'd make of it if we ever got our hands on it? We can be read to from it by him, but we cannot read. Our heads turn towards him. We are expectant. Here comes our bedtime story. The commander sits down and crosses his legs, watched by us. The bookmarks are in place. He opens the book. He clears his throat a little, as if embarrassed. "Could I have a drink of water," he says to the air, "please," he adds. Behind me, one of them, Cora or Rita, leaves her place in the tableau and pads off toward the kitchen. The commander sits, looking down. The commander sighs, taking out a pair of reading glasses from his inside jacket pocket, gold rims, slips them on. Now he looks like a shoemaker in an old fairy tale book. Is there no end to his disguises of benevolence? We watch him, every inch, every flicker. To be a man, watched by women, it must be entirely strange to have them watching him all the time, to have them wondering, what is he going to do next? To have them flinch when he moves, even if it's a harmless enough move, to reach for an ashtray, perhaps, to have them sizing him up, to have them thinking, he can't do it, he won't do, he'll have to do. This last as if he were a garment out of style or shoddy, which must nevertheless be put on because there's nothing else available. To have them putting him on, trying him on, trying him out, while he himself puts them on like a sock over a foot, onto the stub of himself, his extra sensitive thumb, his tentacle, his delicate, stalked slug's eye, which extrudes, expands, winces, and shrivels back into himself when touched wrongly, grows big again, bulging a little at the tip, traveling forward as if along a leaf, into them, avid for vision. To achieve vision in this way, this journey into a darkness that is composed of women, a woman, who can see in darkness while he himself strains blindly forward. She watches him from within. We're all watching him. It's the one thing we really can do. And it is not for nothing. If he were to falter, fail, or die, what would become of us? No wonder he's like a boot, hard on the outside, giving shape to a pulp of tenderfoot. That's just a wish. I've been watching him for some time, and he's given no evidence of softness. But watch out, Commander, I tell him in my head. I've got my eye on you. One false move, and I'm dead. Still, it must be hell to be a man like that. It must be just fine. It must be hell. It must be very silent. The water appears. The commander drinks it. Thank you, he says. Cora rustles back into place. The commander pauses, looking down, scanning the page. He takes his time, as if unconscious of us. He's like a man toying with a steak behind a restaurant window, pretending not to see the eyes watching him from hungry darkness, not 3 feet from his elbow. We lean toward him a little, iron filings to his magnet. He has something we don't have. He has the word. How we squandered it once. The commander, as if reluctantly, begins to read. He isn't very good at it. Maybe he's merely bored. It's the usual story, the usual stories. God to Adam, God to Noah, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Then comes the moldy old Rachel and Leah stuff we had drummed into us at the center. Give me children, or else I die. Am I in God's stead? Who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Behold my maid, Bilhah. She shall bear upon my knees, that I may also have children by her. And so on, and so forth. We had it read to us every breakfast, as we sat in the high school cafeteria eating porridge with cream and brown sugar. You're getting the best, you know, said Aunt Lydia. There's a war on. Things are rationed. You are spoiled girls, she twinkled as if rebuking a kitten. Naughty puss. For lunch, it was the Beatitudes. Blessed be this, blessed be that. They played it from a tape, so not even an aunt would be guilty of the sin of reading. The voice was a man's. "Blessed be the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed be the meek. Blessed are the silent." I knew they made that up. I knew it was wrong, and they left things out, too, but there was no way of checking. "Blessed be those that mourn, for they shall be comforted." Nobody said when. I checked the clock. During dessert, canned pears with cinnamon, standard for lunch, and look for Maura in her place, two tables over. She's gone already. I put my hand up. "I'm excused." We don't do this too often, and always at different times of day. In the washroom, I go to the second last stall as usual. "Are you there?" I whisper. "Large as life and twice as ugly," Maura whispers back. "What have you heard?" I ask her. "Nothing much. I've got to get out of here. I'm going bats." I feel panic. "No, no, Maura," I say. "Don't try it. Not on your own. I'll fake sick. They send an ambulance. I've seen it. You'll only get as far as the hospital. At least it'll be a change. I won't have to listen to that old bitch. They'll find you out. Not to worry. I'm good at it. When I was a kid in high school, I cut out vitamin C. I got scurvy. In the early stages, they can't diagnose it. Then you just start it again and you're fine. I'll hide my vitamin pills." "Maura, don't." I couldn't stand the thought of her not being here, with me, for me. "They send two guys with you in the ambulance. Think about it. They must be starved for it. Shit, they aren't even allowed to put their hands in their pockets. The possibilities are..." "You in there! Time's up," said the voice of Aunt Elizabeth from the doorway. I stood up, flushed the toilet. Two of Maura's fingers appeared through the hole in the wall. It was only large enough for two fingers. I touched my own fingers to them quickly, held on, let go. "And Leah said, 'God hath given me my hire because I have given my maiden to my husband,'" says the commander. He lets the book fall closed. It makes an exhausted sound like a padded door shutting by itself at a distance, a puff of air. The sound suggests the softness of the thin, oniony pages, how they would feel under the fingers, soft and dry, like papier poudre, pink and powdery. From the time before, you'd get it in booklets for taking the shine off your nose, in those stores that sold candles and soap in the shapes of things, seashells, mushrooms, like cigarette paper, like petals. The commander sits with his eyes closed for a moment as if tired. He works long hours. He has a lot of responsibilities. Serena has begun to cry. I can hear her behind my back. It isn't the first time. She always does this the night of the ceremony. She's trying not to make a noise. She's trying to preserve her dignity in front of us. The upholstery and the rugs muffle her, but we can hear her clearly despite that. The tension between her lack of control and her attempt to suppress it is horrible. It's like a fart in church. I feel, as always, the urge to laugh, but not because I think it's funny. The smell of her crying spreads over us, and we pretend to ignore it. The commander opens his eyes, notices, frowns, ceases to notice. "Now we will all have a moment of silent prayer," says the commander. "We will ask for a blessing and for success in all our ventures." I bow my head and close my eyes. I listen to the held breath, the almost inaudible gasps, the shaking going on behind my back. How she must hate me, I think. I pray silently. Nolite te bastardes caberundarum. I don't know what it means, but it sounds right, and it will have to do, because I don't know what else I can say to God. Not right now. Not, as they used to say, at this juncture. The scratched writing on my cupboard wall floats before me, left by an unknown woman with the face of Maura. I saw her go out to the ambulance on a stretcher, carried by two angels. What is it? I mouthed to the woman beside me. Safe enough, a question like that to all but a fanatic. A fever, she formed with her lips. Appendicitis, they say. I was having dinner that evening, hamburger balls and hashed browns. My table was near the window. I could see out as far as the front gates. I saw the ambulance come back, no siren this time. One of the angels jumped out, talked with the guard. The guard went into the building. The ambulance stayed parked. The angel stood with his back towards us, as they had been taught to do. Two of the aunts came out of the building with the guard. They went around to the back. They hauled Mara out, dragged her in through the gate and up the front steps, holding her under the armpits, one on each side. She was having trouble walking. I stopped eating. I couldn't eat. By this time, all of us on my side of the table were staring out the window. The window was greenish with that chicken wire mesh they used to put inside glass. Aunt Lydia said, "Eat your dinner." She went over and pulled down the blind. They took her into the room that used to be the science lab. It was a room where none of us ever went willingly. Afterwards, she could not walk for a week. Her feet would not fit into her shoes. They were too swollen. It was the feet they'd do for a first offense. They used steel cables frayed at the ends. After that, the hands. They didn't care what they did to your feet or your hands, even if it was permanent. Remember, said Aunt Lydia, for our purposes, your feet and your hands are not essential. Mara lay on her bed, an example. She shouldn't have tried it, not with the angels, Alma said from the next bed over. We had to carry her to classes. We stole extra paper packets of sugar for her from the cafeteria at mealtimes, smuggled them to her at night, handing them from bed to bed. Probably she didn't need the sugar, but it was the only thing we could find to steal, to give. I'm still praying, but what I'm seeing is Mara's feet, the way they looked after they'd brought her back. Her feet did not look like feet at all. They looked like drowned feet, swollen and boneless, except for the color. They looked like lungs. Oh, God, I pray. Nolite te bastardes carborundum. Is this what you had in mind? The commander clears his throat. This is what he does to let us know that in his opinion it's time we stopped praying. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, to know himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him, he says. It's the sign-off. He stands up. We are dismissed. 16. The ceremony goes as usual. I lie on my back, fully clothed, except for the healthy white cotton underdrawers. What I could see, if I were to open my eyes, would be the large white canopy of Serena Joy's outsized, colonial-style four-poster bed, suspended like a sagging cloud above us, a cloud sprigged with tiny drops of silver rain, which, if you looked at them closely, would turn out to be four-petaled flowers. I would not see the carpet, which is white, or the sprigged curtains and skirted dressing table with its silver-backed brush and mirror set, only the canopy, which manages to suggest at one and the same time, by the gauziness of its fabric and its heavy downward curve, both ethereality and matter. Or the sail of a ship. Big-bellied sails, they used to say in poems, bellying, propelled forward by a swollen belly. A mist of lily of the valley surrounds us, chilly, crisp almost. It's not warm in this room. Above me, toward the head of the bed, Serena Joy is arranged, outspread. Her legs are apart. I lie between them, my head on her stomach, her pubic bone under the base of my skull, her thighs on either side of me. She, too, is fully clothed. My arms are raised She holds my hands, each of mine and each of hers. This is supposed to signify that we are one flesh, one being. What it really means is that she is in control of the process and thus of the product, if any. The rings of her left hand cut into my fingers. It may or may not be revenge. My red skirt is hitched up to my waist, though no higher. Below it, the commander is fucking. What he is fucking is the lower part of my body. I do not say making love, because this is not what he's doing. Copulating, too, would be inaccurate, because it would imply two people and only one is involved. Nor does rape cover it. Nothing is going on here that I haven't signed up for. There wasn't a lot of choice, but there was some, and this is what I chose. Therefore, I lie still and picture the unseen canopy over my head. I remember Queen Victoria's advice to her daughter, close your eyes and think of England. But this is not England. I wish he would hurry up. Maybe I'm crazy, and this is some new kind of therapy. I wish it were true. Then I could get better, and this would go away. Serena Joy grips my hands, as if it is she, not I, who's being fucked, as if she finds it either pleasurable or painful, and the commander fucks with a regular 2-4 marching stroke, on and on like a tap dripping. He is preoccupied, like a man humming to himself in the shower without knowing he's humming, like a man who has other things on his mind. It's as if he's somewhere else, waiting for himself to come, drumming his fingers on the table while he waits. There's an impatience in his rhythm now. But isn't this everyone's wet dream, two women at once? They used to say that. Exciting, they used to say. What's going on in this room, under Serena Joy's silvery canopy, is not exciting. It has nothing to do with passion, or love, or romance, or any of those other notions we used to titillate ourselves with. It has nothing to do with sexual desire, at least for me, and certainly not for Serena. Arousal and orgasm are no longer thought necessary. They would be a symptom of frivolity merely, like jazz garters or beauty spots, superfluous distractions for the light-minded, outdated. It seems odd that women once spent such time and energy reading about such things, thinking about them, worrying about them, writing about them. They are so obviously recreational. This is not recreation, even for the commander. This is serious business. The commander, too, is doing his duty. If I were going to open my eyes a slit, I would be able to see him. His not unpleasant face hanging over my torso, with a few strands of his silver hair falling, perhaps, over his forehead, intent on his inner journey, that place he is hurrying towards, which recedes, as in a dream, at the same speed with which he approaches it, I would see his open eyes. If he were better looking, would I enjoy this more? Well, at least he's an improvement on the previous one, who smelled like a church cloakroom in the rain, like your mouth when the dentist starts picking at your teeth, like a nostril. The commander, instead, smells of mothballs. Or is this odor some punitive form of aftershave? Why does he have to wear that stupid uniform? But would I like his white, tufted, raw body any better? Kissing is forbidden between us. This makes it bearable. One detaches oneself. One describes. He comes at last with a stifled groan as of relief. Serena Joy, who has been holding her breath, expels it. The commander, who has been propping himself on his elbows away from our combined bodies, doesn't permit himself to sink down into us. He rests a moment, withdraws, recedes, re-zippers. He nods, then turns and leaves the room, closing the door with exaggerated care behind him, as if both of us are his ailing mother. There's something hilarious about this, but I don't dare laugh. Serena Joy lets go of my hands. "You can get up now," she says. "Get up and get out." She's supposed to have me rest for 10 minutes with my feet on a pillow to improve the chances. This is meant to be a time of silent meditation for her, but she's not in the mood for that. There is loathing in her voice, as if the touch of my flesh sickens and contaminates her. I untangle myself from her body, stand up, the juice of the commander runs down my legs. Before I turn away, I see her straighten her blue skirt, clench her legs together. She continues lying on the bed, gazing up at the canopy above her, stiff and straight as an effigy. Which of us is it worse for, her or me? 17. This is what I do when I'm back in my room. I take off my clothes and put on my nightgown. I look for the pat of butter in the toe of my right shoe where I hid it after dinner. The cupboard was too warm. The butter is semi-liquid. Much of it has sunk into the paper napkin I wrapped it in. Now I'll have butter in my shoe. Not the first time, because whenever there is butter or even margarine, I save some in this way. I can get most of the butter off the shoe lining with a washcloth or some toilet paper from the bathroom tomorrow. I rub the butter over my face, work it into the skin of my hands. There's no longer any hand lotion or face cream, not for us. Such things are considered vanities. We are containers. It is only the insides of our bodies that are important. The outside can become hard and wrinkled for all they care, like the shell of a nut. This was a decree of the wives, this absence of hand lotion. They don't want us to look attractive. For them, things are bad enough as it is. The butter is a trick I learned at the Rachel and Leah Center. The Red Center, we called it, because there was so much red. My predecessor in this room, my friend with the freckles and the good laugh, must have done this too, this buttering. We all do it. As long as we do this, butter our skin to keep it soft, we can believe that we will someday get out, that we will be touched again, in love or desire. We have ceremonies of our own, private ones. The butter is greasy, and it will go rancid, and I will smell like an old cheese, but at least it's organic, as they used to say. To such devices have we descended. Buttered, I lie on my single bed, flat like a piece of toast. I can't sleep. In the semi-dark, I stare up at the blind plaster eye in the middle of the ceiling, which stares back down at me, even though it can't see. There's no breeze. My white curtains are like gauze bandages, hanging limp, glimmering in the aura cast by the searchlight that illuminates this house at night. Or is there a moon? I fold back the sheet, get carefully up on silent bare feet in my nightgown, go to the window like a child. I want to see the moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow. The sky is clear but hard to make out because of the searchlight, but yes, in the obscured sky, a moon does float, newly, a wishing moon, a sliver of ancient rock, a goddess, a wink. The moon is a stone, and the sky is full of deadly hardware, but, oh God, how beautiful anyway. I want Luke here so badly. I want to be held and told my name. I want to be valued in ways that I am not. I want to be more than valuable. I repeat my former name, remind myself of what I once could do, how others saw me. I want to steal something. In the hall, the nightlight's on. The long space glows gently pink. I walk, one foot set carefully down, then the other, without creaking, along the runner, as if on a forest floor, sneaking, my heart quick, through the night house. I am out of place. This is entirely illegal. Down past the fisheye on the hall wall, I can see my white shape of tented body. Hair down my back like a mane, my eyes gleaming. I like this. I am doing something on my own. The active. Is it a tense? Tensed. What I would like to steal is a knife from the kitchen, but I'm not ready for that. I reach the sitting room. Doors ajar, slip in, leave the door a little open. A squeak of wood, but who's near enough to hear? I stand in the room, letting the pupils of my eyes dilate like a cat's or owl's. Old perfume, cloth dust, fill my nostrils. There's a slight mist of light coming through the cracks around the closed drapes, from the searchlight outside, where two men doubtless patrol. I've seen them from above, from behind my curtains, dark shapes, cutouts. Now I can see outlines, gleams, from the mirror, the bases of the lamps, the vases, the sofa looming like a cloud at dusk. What should I take? Something that will not be missed. In the wood at midnight, a magic flower, a withered daffodil, not one from the dried arrangement. The daffodils will soon be thrown out. They're beginning to smell, along with Serena's stale fumes, the stench of her knitting. I grope, find an end table, feel. There's a clink. I must have knocked something. I find the daffodils, crisp at the edges where they've dried, limp toward the stems, use my fingers to pinch. I will press this somewhere, under the mattress. Leave it there for the next woman, the one who comes after me, to find. But there's someone in the room, behind me. I hear the step, quiet as mine, the creaking of the same floorboard. The door closes behind me with a little click, cutting the light. I freeze. White was a mistake. I'm snow in moonlight, even in the dark. Then a whisper. Don't scream. It's all right. As if I'd scream. As if it's all right. I turn. A shape. That's all. Dull glint of cheekbone, devoid of color. He steps toward me. Nick. What are you doing in here? I don't answer. He too is illegal. Here, with me. He can't give me away. Nor I him. For the moment, we're mirrors. He puts his hand on my arm, pulls me against him, his mouth on mine. What else comes from such denial? Without a word, both of us shaking. How I'd like to. In Serena's parlor, with the dried flowers on the Chinese carpet, his thin body, a man entirely unknown. It would be like shouting. It would be like shooting someone. My hand goes down. How about that? I could unbutton, and then...
This ends side one of cassette three. Please turn the cassette over and start side two from the same point.